Good morning. How is everyone today?
Good.
Glad y'all are here. We've got quite a few that are left over from last session. How many are left over from last session? Wow. Okay. All right. For those of you who weren't here for the last session, Jimmy's got some good stuff to say. We're going to go ahead and start off with a prayer, and then I'll introduce Jimmy, and then I'll turn it over to him. He's got lots of good content. Let's pray. Holy Father, we thank you for today and the blessings that you showered upon us. God, we thank you for the opportunity that we have to study your word. God, opportunities to study about issues that are problems in the church. And God, how we can help those who need help. God, we thank you for your son. We thank you for his cleansing blood. And God, it's in his name that we pray. Amen. All right. Jimmy Hinton grew up in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, just over a mile from where United 93 went down on 9/11. He's a faithful husband, father of three beautiful children, and he's a full-time minister. Some of the unique things about Jimmy is in 2011, he discovered that his father was a pedophile and that he had been a pedophile for his entire adult life. One of the more troubling things that Jimmy dealt with this is the fact that despite having 2 degrees and years of experience in ministry, no one had prepared him for what the impact would be on his family, his community, and his church. One of the other troubling facts that I guess you could say haunted Jimmy was the fact that over 90% of pedophiles identify themselves as religious, and that this is one topic that churches just remain naive about. As a minister and co-founder of Church Protect, he works to bring this information to the front of mind. I met Jimmy about 3 years ago as I was beginning the Ezekiel 33 project, and I saw an article about him in the Christian Chronicle, reached out to him. And after conversing with him, I quickly realized that we're working towards the same goal, main difference being mileage in between us, and just a slightly different twist and approach. We bounce ideas off of each other periodically, and we pray for each other regularly. And he's uniquely qualified to speak on this topic because of his unique situation. He's a researcher and a minister. Jimmy lived under the roof of a pedophile for over 20 years. So as a result, he knows how, I guess you would say, pedophiles live in the wild, as opposed to in a controlled situation where if they're talking with someone that's interviewing them, the pedophile can give them whatever information they want, and they don't know, it's not verifiable. But living under the same roof as the individual, you get to know the individual rather well. As a minister, Jimmy is uniquely aware of the intricacies of the church and how our weaknesses can be exploited, along with the spiritual impacts that can happen whenever such an event as these occur and how it can impact those in the faith. Jimmy?
Steve, my computer turned blue, so I don't know what's going on there. That's it. Well, thank you again for those who are, you endured session one and now you're session two, and I see a lot of new faces for this next session. So in the first session, I was basically just, I told a little bit of my story, how we discovered in 2011 that my dad, who was a preacher for 27 years, had sexually abused dozens and dozens of children. We believe that number is actually in the hundreds, but the abuse was disclosed to me by one of my dad's victims. So my mother and I were the two who reported him to police. In 2012, he received a 30 to 60 year prison sentence, and so he will die in prison. The first time that he's eligible for parole, he'll be 92 years old. So It's been quite a journey, and I launched a ministry with a co-founder, John Euler, and it's called Church Protect Incorporated. So what we do is we help churches walk through the aftermath of abuse. We do a lot of consulting with churches all the way from our biggest was 15,000 members down to 50 members. And so churches all over the country, we do consulting with churches when they find out that there's either been abuse or allegations of abuse, and we walk them through that and basically teach them how to take a hard biblical approach and how to protect vulnerable people, vulnerable children, and people who've already been victimized. That's our number one goal, is to get the predator out and to protect the children from any more harm. And we don't apologize for that, and that's just always number one priority. Interestingly, I told the first group, the number one question that we get asked when churches consult with us is, how do we help this brother, talking about the predator, the pedophile, how do we help restore this brother back into the life of the church? They're asking the wrong question. The question should be, how do we find out for sure who all of his victims are? And what do we do to protect them from ever coming into contact, be it physical or phone call, email, letters by mail, any of that stuff? How do we protect his victims from ever coming into contact with him again? That's the question that ought to be asked. I don't think we've ever been asked that question to date. So what I started doing, kind of my forte became, it stemmed out of an unhealthy obsession. I wanted to get inside of the mind of the predator. And the only predator who I was close enough to be able to do that was my own father. And so I maintained very close contact with him and still do. And have hundreds of letters back and forth between us with him in prison and me on the outside. And so I just wanted to pick his brain. And it is a really, I've got to tell you this, it is a really dark, dark place. I am, to my knowledge, the only researcher in this country and possibly around the world who's lived under the same roof as a pedophile. So what that means is all the research that's been done to date about pedophiles has been from people in academia fields sending their grad assists and things like that into prisons to interview people who are incarcerated and to ask them questions, and they don't have a clue what these guys look like on the outside. What did they look like prior to their incarceration? And the other thing is a lot of the information that we're getting is very inaccurate. These guys are they're liars, and they do it really well. Deception is their forte. So in gathering good information, reliable information, I had to become a master at deception. And so it's kind of a weird, it's a weird thing, but being a full-time preacher, it's kind of a strange thing to also understand deception and want to understand deception. So with that, I started realizing, it's what I talked about at the end of the last group, and I'm going to show you some of these fruits. I started talking about fruits that my dad was producing, and so that ended up being an assessment tool that I created, and it's a way to profile people. And don't be afraid of that term, because with all the racial stuff that's going on, we're really afraid of that term. Profiling is actually it's a normal thing. It's a biblical thing. And there's my mom writing me messages. You'll find about 1,000 of those. She's in Haiti right now. And if I knew how to turn the notifications off, I would. But you'll just have to deal with it. So what's interesting is Jesus and I wrestled a lot. And he was talking about these fruits that wolves in sheep's clothing produce. He said, two different times in Matthew chapter 7, you will recognize them by their fruits. That bothered me a lot. Because for years and years and years and years, none of us saw it with my dad. Never in a million years would we have said, gee, I wonder if he's raping little children. just wasn't on our radar. And so I started to wrestle with that passage, and I was like, well, my theology was always bad people don't produce fruit. It's not what Jesus says. He says, you will recognize them by their fruits. Well, then that bothered me, because then I'm thinking, well, if you're producing bad fruits, where are all these bad fruits that my dad produced? You know, he was a good dad. He was kind. He was a preacher. I went in ministry because of his influence. He went to all the kids' ball games. He was a present father. So where are these bad fruits that the guy was producing? So then I started going back in time, and I started thinking about times that he was gaining access to his victims in order to sexualize them, which was very often. I'm sorry about that. That's going to bother me. Natalie, can you text her and tell her to shh? My wife's phone has been dinging off the hook because of these messages. I'm not kidding. She'll send 100 within the next hour. Everybody, Clara Hinton, everybody. So it really bothered me, and I was like, well, how's he gaining access to the victims? And then the next thing that bothered me was, well, every time he's gaining access to victims, not only are we not being weirded out, but the exact opposite's taking place. People are giving him pats on the shoulder. People are literally giving him their kids. And they're saying, well, when can you babysit my kid? And so he was smiling all the way to the proverbial bank, because he's taking these kids off and he's not even having to ask for them. And he's victimizing them. And so he ended up, I had mentioned this, I think, in the first session, but maybe not. But I know I mentioned he's a sexually violent predator, but that was removed as part of his plea deal. So an SVP designation means he is the worst of the worst. He is, think somebody in camouflage who hunts in the woods and will spend 10 hours until they get a kill. And if you think I'm exaggerating, he wrote in great detail in one letter how he would hide in the baptistry, in the church building where I preach now. He would hide inside of the baptistry, and when kids would come into the handicapped restroom, he would come out of the baptistry, he would molest them, he would threaten them, and then he would get up, he'd walk out of the bathroom, he'd get up and he would preach. I mean, this is what they do. This is SVPs. So when we consult with churches at Church Protect, the vast majority of predators that are coming out of prison, when you have sex offenders coming out of prison going into churches, and the church leaders are just doting over them, what wonderful people they are and how they found Jesus in prison, the vast majority of the churches that John and I consult with have as predators coming into the churches from prison people with the designation sexually violent predator. They're the worst of the worst. They will always produce more victims, period. So this tool is designed to help us see some of the things in these predators. And so the fruits that my dad was producing on the outside looked beautiful. They looked appealing. That's why people were giving their kids into the hands of my father and saying, here, why don't you babysit? Babysit all of my kids. It's because on the outside, these fruits looked really good. And people are saying things like, my goodness, you're so busy. You have 11 kids of your own, and you have a full-time job, and you're just so busy, and yet you still find time for these wonderful children. And that's what people saw, because on the outside, the fruits that he was producing look like fruits that you and I produce. So if this looks eerily familiar, I've had people stop me, and they're like, well, wait a second, this looks like me. I'm like, that's the point. But it's not until we dissect the fruit and open them up and look at what's on the inside that we realize on the inside they're completely rotten. So education is, I mentioned this at the very end of the last one. Education on the outside, it looks great. Wonderful. We should educate kids. I'm sure we have a lot of educators in this room or people who are in school to be educators. I'm an educator. Education is great. But what's it look like on the inside? When you break it open and you look at what's on the inside, a perpetrator describes a need to educate kids. Oh, I need to have a Bible study with little Susie. They find, I need to take that word out. They produce opportunities to instruct children alone. They might have before or after church Bible studies with kids in private. They'll teach them sex ed, how to put on a bra, change underwear, kiss, perform sexually. Children will be forced to view pornography and perform sexual acts. They'll become the perpetrator will become possessive of Bible studies. Anyone who interferes will only dismantle what the wolf has accomplished. They've so manipulated children that children feel the need to be around, and they'll actually defend the offender. And the feelings are mixed for the kid. While there might be reluctance for the child, the perpetrator makes it fun enough that the child still wants to spend time with the abuser, at least for a while. And I put persistence at the end of these because this is the constant that never changes with abusers. They're always persistent in every single avenue of life. They're persistent. My wife is sitting here in the audience. Ironically, we moved to Pennsylvania in 2007 because my mom and dad had just separated, not because she knew anything about him being a child sexual abuser, but they had separated after 30-some years of marriage. We felt sorry for my dad, and so my wife and I were newlyweds. We moved up to Pennsylvania, and the day that we moved in to our rental place, my dad moved in with us. He lived with us for 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, my wife so despised my dad that she said, "We're buying a new house and your dad doesn't come with it." And there was nothing that indicated to us that he was abusing kids, but he was just annoying and persistent. I was driving truck at the time, and my wife said, I just remembered different things like this. My wife said, I'm going to cook a really nice meal for Jimmy when he gets home. What did my dad do? He not only cooked, but he cooked so much food that like stuff was splashing over the counter onto the carpet, and like absolutely defiant. We came on home one day to find our freezer duct taped shut. He had made so much food after being told not to that he just took it 10 steps farther. He made so much food that he had to duct tape literally the freezer shut. It's this persistence. And just getting under the skin, but doing it in a nice way where who's going to come back and say, "You know, you son of a gun, you just made all this food. I was just doing you a favor." This is what they do. And they're always persistent. Life skills. This is another one of the 20 fruits that these guys are producing. He describes a need. Listen to the terminology. It's very important. A need to teach a child safe skills, or life skills, rather. For example, how the world really is. They'll usually do this through nature hikes, campouts, things like that. Taking them out to show them, you know, the different kinds of trees and to get them to name leaves. Bribery takes place at this level. Offering companionship via quality time spent outdoors, learning to drive a car, going to ball games. Y'all remember Jerry Sandusky? What did he do at Penn State? Where was he taking the kids? Football games. Let me ask you this question. What parent would say no to that? Right? It's Jerry Sandusky. Of course my kid can go to an out-of-town game. What was Jerry Sandusky doing once you break that fruit open and you look on the inside? Things like his organization that shut down, the Second Mile. And he created an organization to help all these little kids. So they teach them to drive cars, go to ball games. Both kids and parents more than happy to oblige. What kid is going to say no to going to a ball game? It's the alone time that we need to keep an eye on, though. When you break these fruit open, these guys are always finding time to be alone with the kids, period. Images. Perpetrators obsessed with picture taking and posting pictures of children and or his or herself online. He'll take random photos of kids and lots of them. Now I say this, watch at church functions. The wolf will walk around casually taking pictures of kids. This can be mental snapshots too. It doesn't have to have a camera. My dad once made the comment, I had visited him in prison, and he said, "You know, I can tell When I walk into a room, within 3 seconds, I can tell who all the predators are. And I said, well, that's a pretty bold statement. How can you tell? He said, it's really simple. I look at their eyes. Isn't that interesting? Now, you and I are thinking, well, wait, what about the eyes? Do you look at the eyes and are they empty? Or they, like, what about the eyes? He knows how to interpret eye movement. I now know how to interpret eye movement. It's not. There's a difference between a look like this and a look like this, you know? It's the gazing look, and it's the staring at the child like 3 seconds too long. It's the up and down eye scan. It's things like that, that most people, the vast majority of people, would never even, it wouldn't even be on their radar. But these guys are constantly creating these images, whether it's mental or whether they're taking actual pictures, and they're posting them all over Facebook. I've profiled people before. I've had people call me up, and they're like, hey, we have this guy, and, you know, it's just some really bizarre behavior. Can you look at their social media? That's the first thing I do. I look at social media. I've reported 5 people now. Now, it's never gone anywhere, unfortunately, because it's not illegal to put even gross pictures of kids on your Facebook page. But it's the first thing that I see, and I've made 5 police reports on guys, some of them prominent guys in the Church of Christ. I'm not afraid to say it. It's everywhere. They put pictures of these little kids and sitting in their laps, and one guy in motel rooms, he travels a lot. And he meets complete strangers from churches and different places. And he's taking selfies. He's laying on his hotel room. He's got these kids laying all over him. And he's taking pictures of them, taking videos of, like, spraying cologne and all kinds of stuff on these little kids. And he's putting videos of them on Facebook. And people are liking them. They're like, my goodness, isn't this wonderful? When you travel, like, you even take time in your busy schedule to, you know, to entertain kids in your hotel room. I'm like, this is nuts. So that's the kind of stuff that they do, and they're not hiding it. So don't think, now some people do, but most of them, when they get to a certain point, and especially the SVP status, sexually violent predators, the worst of the worst, these guys are brazenly and boldly putting this stuff out there because they're making fun of people. They're making fun of us, trust me. They're making fun of us, and they're saying, you people are so stupid, I'm putting it right in front of your face. And you're giving me thumbs up, and you're talking about how much these kids love it. I asked my dad about it. I was like, why did you do stuff like that? He's like, to mock people. He's like, you know, there are a couple of reasons for doing it, but he said the biggest reason is just, he said, you put the stuff out there. And he's like, I couldn't believe how stupid everybody was. His words. He wrote me in multiple letters. I couldn't believe how naive and how stupid the adults were. I'd asked him a question once. I said, what was the biggest thing that surprised you over 46 or 47 years of sexually assaulting and terrorizing kids? What was the biggest thing that surprised you? His answer, well, you would think that it would surprise me that it was so easy to molest the kids, but it wasn't. He's like, because they're kids. He said, they're easy targets. He said, but there were times where I had to pinch myself and say, am I really dreaming, or are these people that this stupid? He said, the biggest thing that surprised me was how blatant I could be in front of adults, and they never caught on to it. So that's why, you know, I said in the first session, if we think that they're wrestling with this, and that they're like, my goodness, you know, what am I doing, and they're struggling with the conscience, they're not. So watch for these kinds of things. I'm not going to go through all 20 of these, because I actually have another presentation that I want to show some. Compliments. We all like compliments, right? It's nice to give compliments. We should compliment people. Listen to the words. And don't be afraid to call people on it. Have them repeat it. I've had people make such weird comments that it's one of those things like, did I really just hear that? And you hesitate. In that moment when you hesitate, they see your hesitation, and guess what they do? They walk away. They put it out there, and they walk away. here's what we need to do. What did you just say? That's a fair question because it just came out of their mouth. You're not being prying. You're not being weird. Ask them the question, what did you just say? I had a guy who told me once, I met him in like 5 minutes, and this guy just made every hair on my body stand up, so much so that I was like, I need to walk up and introduce myself to this guy. So I went up, and I shook hands with him, and within 5 minutes, here's where the conversation went. He started talking about working in inner city ministries. And he's a school teacher, and he works with these troubled kids. And so I'm listening, and I'm like, I think I know where this is going. So he said, and I have a student. He said, he's a young guy. He said, really handsome. Right away, I'm thinking, okay, highly inappropriate. He said, he's really handsome, and he said, he just has such a troubled home. And he said, I started giving him a ride to school. By the way, transportation is one of the fruits here. Transportation, the willful offer rides to children and almost always frames it as the child needs a ride. He's all too quick to create opportunities to transport children. His MO is to do this alone. He will use alone time in the car as an opportunity to grope the child, further groom, threaten, rape, or just plain offer companionship while transporting the child in his personal vehicle. Many molesters use their car's mobile grooming station. The trunk will oftentimes be full of food, toys, lubricants, camping gear, swimming gear, children's clothes, sunblock, etc. My wife and I had the unfortunate experience of cleaning my dad's car out when he got arrested. You wouldn't believe. I literally mean you couldn't fit a toothpick into that trunk. It was so full of this kind of stuff. So common. So common. So, anyway, transportation. Which one was I on? Yeah, so compliments. You'll find these inappropriate comments. How cute, sexy, adorable kids are. So this guy that I introduced myself, he said, yeah, I go into the inner city and there's this, you know, this handsome boy. There was the inappropriate comment. And he said, I even stop, he said, every morning on the way to school, verbatim, this is what he said, I even stop and I help him bathe every morning before school. And if you have school teachers that just happen to pick you up on the way to school when you were a kid, dunk you in the bathtub on the way, right? And it, like, that was way early on. That was before Church Protect existed. This was right after my dad had been arrested. And it was that shock factor. Like, did I really just hear what I heard? I knew I heard it. And I didn't call him on it. Now when I hear those sorts of things, I'm like, what did you say? Wait, can you describe that? And ask for details. And you'll see their face get red. That's not embarrassment. Those who are in the first session, what is that? Why is their face red? Anger. Because you're poking that facade. You're asking them questions. They do not like it. And they're going to come back and they're going to call you judgmental and arrogant. And you just misunderstood them. And they're going to get angry. It's another telltale sign. Okay. Anybody who wants the rest of these, I'm going to email them. I'm going to give another presentation, and then I'm going to do a demonstration, or maybe a couple demonstrations, just to show you some of the benign tactics that abusers use. Everything is about testing. Everything's about testing. So I want to get inside of the mind of a predator, but I also want to get into our own minds. So how did we miss it? What was it about us that said, we feel slimy, right? That's our intuition kicking in. We feel slimy, but we don't know why. We know when we're being fooled. Anybody ever buy a car? Anybody ever drive off the lot with a car when you were like, there's no way? There's no way I'm letting them manipulate me into buying that car. It's the price is too high. And then you're driving off the lot, and you're like, that jerk, you know? Like, anybody, this will go back in time. Anybody own a Kirby vacuum? Yeah? So these guys come into the house, right, and you'll appreciate it. They walk in, and they do their demonstration, and you're like, man, that's a cool vacuum. Before they come into your house, they're like getting the snake oil out and rubbing it on their suits. And then they come into your house, and they tell you this wonderful vacuum. And then, what, $1,500 later, you're writing the check out, and they're walking out, they're smiling, and you're left with this Kirby, which is a decent vacuum. But you're left with this question, what just happened? And it's quick, right? It's quick. What is it about us that allows that to happen? So we like to think we've got this figured out. John and I constantly, we have these, what we call the child super predators coming to churches, and churches are like, well, we know that they spent time in prison, and I can write the script for what they talk about. Let me guess. They had one victim. It happened back in 1965. It's so long ago that they can't even remember the kid's name. And in fact, when you brought it up just now, you're tormenting this poor guy all over again because he's worked so hard to forgive himself. Am I right? And they always say, well, yeah, something like that. I'm like, pull up their court records. Find out what they really did. Find out how many victims they have. Find out the nature of their crimes. You've got to do your homework. Figure it out. So we like to think we've got it figured out. So we hear people, we're face to face with them, and all of a sudden everything just melts away. This anger that we might have towards them, it just melts away. Because we see their tears, or we see their smiling face, or they compliment us, or whatever it is, and we start getting drawn into that. And so we have churches constantly, and they tell us, well, we know we have sex offenders, you know, all through the congregation, but we're going to keep an eye on them. And I'm like, not really the guy to make that argument with, that you've got enough skill to be able to keep an eye on them, and they're not going to produce more victims. So that's what I'm going to give you guys a couple demonstrations just to demonstrate that. So I'm going to play the predator and have you guys like lock me down as tight as you can, and we'll see if you can keep me safe, keep this room safe. It won't be anything weird or bizarre or inappropriate or anything like that. So, how do we get to that point? How do we become so naive? There's something going on inside of all of us, and we have what's reality, which is the real world. That's just it's reality. This table is green, right? No, I don't even know. Gray? Okay, so that's concrete. That's reality. Gray is gray. Gray never changes. So this table is gray. Though it's cloudy, that's water that's in this bottle. They're concrete things. That's reality. It's just the way life works. But then there's this other thing going on beside reality, which is our want-to-believe system. That's what I call it. It's what we want to believe or what we don't want to believe in certain people. And that without our, it's not like we're like, well, I'm going to make this my new reality, but that's exactly what happens. So this becomes our new reality. So what we want to believe about people or what we don't want to believe about people becomes our new reality. So I'll give a couple examples of this. You remember a couple years ago, Katy Perry, just before she got up on stage and sung I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It, she tweeted out a Bible verse. Anybody remember that? This was like national news. I had friends in ministry that were talking about Katy Perry's sermon and how wonderful. I'm like, she tweeted a Bible verse. And they're like, Katy Perry, she's turning around and she loves Jesus. And I was like, I'm not really convinced. She still mocks Christianity but whatever. So I found this article, and it was kind of interesting because this gets into the psychology of who we are. And what John and I experience when we consult with churches, this want-to-believe system becomes much more powerful than actual reality. It's a powerful, powerful thing. So this guy by the name of Carlos Rodriguez writes this article, and this is just an excerpt from his article. There was something like, did you see the tweet that Katy Perry just tweeted out to 200 and some million Americans? So he says, I'm not sure, but I want to believe God spoke to Katy. I want to believe he's still speaking to her right now, because that's whose hope? My hope. For everyone who's lost or broken or famous or perfect, that they will hear vibrations of love and the sounds of salvation himself. I don't even know what that means. But that's his new reality because that's what he wants to hope. I want so bad for this to be true. I want so bad to believe that this guy found Jesus in prison. Whatever it is, we want so badly to believe that, that becomes our new reality. It's a powerful, powerful thing, and it sits parallel to actual reality, which is where there are facts and there's evidence and things like that. So abusers know this, and they exploit our belief system. Magicians, I talked in the last session, this is what magicians do. I like to do some cheesy magic tricks with our 7-year-old daughter. And one of those, it's called the French grab. Does anybody know what that is? So it's just basically the coin toss from this hand into this hand, and then, oh, look, there's no coin. So it's called the French grab. Do you know that you actually see the coin go into this hand even though it doesn't? So the coin begins in this hand. You drop it into that hand, or supposedly drop it in. Your brain actually makes that connection, and you physically see the coin going into this hand even though it doesn't. Why does that happen? Because of this want-to-believe system. We're so accustomed to seeing that your brain actually creates a shortcut, and it's just an optical illusion. It's a very powerful thing, and abusers know it. So this guy, this was a series of interviews that Dr. Anna Salter did with some inmates in Alabama State Prison. This guy said, "I consider people that go to church gullible because they have a trust that comes from being Christians. They seem to want to believe in the good that exists in all people. Because of that, it was easy for me to convince them. Because of that, you can convince them with or without convincing words." This guy was the youngest deacon in the state of Alabama in the Methodist Church. He was in prison, caught with 53 male victims, all prepubescent. And the guy, when he was in prison, he was in like his late 20s. And when you watch him, you can find this interview on YouTube. I just type in Dr. Anna Salter, prison interviews. And you'll find these, that's where these quotes came from. She also mentions them in her book. This other guy, "I think people are easy to fool." And Anna asked, "Why do you think they're so easy to fool?" Because they want to believe in something. They want to hope. They want to believe. There's something inside of people that makes them want to believe in the best in things and the best in others because the alternative is not very nice. And then she asked the same guy, she said, "If I wanted to fool people, what advice would you give me? What's the best way to do it? How do I act? What do I do? To be polite. To be kind. To show kindness, especially in public." Now, does this sound calculated? Especially, one-to-one, you be polite to them, but especially when you're in public, that's when you really crank it up. You put this facade on constantly. You wear it like clothes every day. This isn't accidental. You smile even when you don't want to smile, when you don't feel like smiling. You say the things that you think people might want to hear. This is my hope. This is what I want to believe. These guys know it, and they're tapping into it. They're hacking our belief system. So they know our language. They know our religious language. They speak church talk really well. I'm a minister. I speak church talk, right? I can guide, guard, and direct every prayer in the right direction. I speak church talk. I can walk in and talk to anybody in even different denominations, and within minutes, you can adapt your talk and you can speak their church talk. These guys do it. And then they get in and they know what we want to believe in or don't want to believe in, and so they hack that and they play with it. He said, "You exercise that sympathy. This was a rapist who forcefully entered a young woman's home, and he repeatedly beat, raped, and sodomized her while her 18-month-old baby was asleep in the other room." This is another guy. "Did you find people easy or hard to fool?" "Well, that depends on whether they care or not." Isn't that interesting? What an interesting response. "Well, it depends on whether they care or not." People in general, they're going to think what they want to think, and that's basically all there is to it. If you can stare someone in the eye and lie, they're going to say, "He didn't even blink or look away. He's pretty straight here." The more nervous you can make the victim, isn't this interesting? We ask this question when we consult with churches. Why would you place the predator who produced these victims in the same congregation, in the same space, in the same universe as their victims? Well, Jesus works miracles. I'm like, where do you find like this garbage theology? Listen to this guy. He says, the more nervous you can make the victim, the more it looks like they're the ones lying. Just a simple look to the child is traumatizing. This incarcerated guy, incarcerated twice, he raped an 8-year-old girl. Very badly, I'll spare you the details. It's another guy. I think generally society is easy to fool, extremely easy to fool. And I say that because of how long I've fooled society and how long I've fooled people. I've been fooling people for well over 25 years, and people have believed what I've been telling them. This is a sadist with over 300 victims, brutally raped and tortured his stunned wife for years. This guy turned himself into the police station, and the cops were laughing, and they were like, yeah, right. And the guy walked out. And went on to abuse for years after that. Now, I know right now what people are thinking. Well, you've been talking about conscience, and you know these people don't have a conscience at all. So why would this guy turn himself into the police? Nobody caught him. There's no evidence that came up. Why would he walk himself into the police station? Anybody? That's exactly right. The guy went in. And with a smile on his face, he's like, yeah, I tied up and, you know, and went into detail. It was joking with the cops, and the cops start joking back, and they were like, yeah, right. And they let the guy walk out. Never opened an investigation. The guy did it to taunt them. It's pretty wild stuff. The spooky truth is that your brain constructs reality, visual or otherwise. What you see, hear, feel, and think is based on what you expect to see, hear, feel, and think. In turn, your expectations are based on all your prior experiences and memories. This comes from an incredible book written by a husband-wife team who are neuroscientists called Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions. This is an incredible book. When I read this book, I was like, this is my father. This is him. He's using all these techniques. It's about skill set development. These guys are highly skilled people. So that's my last slide here. I want to do a couple demonstrations because inevitably, we don't get asked this question. We get told this response. Well, we have a policy that says, you know, we're going to keep an eye on predators, and we have one of the safest congregations because, you know, we have, like, you know, on average, churches that I know of have between 2 and 3. Our average congregations are about 100 in the Churches of Christ. My travels around the country, on average, every single congregation that I've been to, talked to, interacted with, and it's in the dozens. Every single one of them, 100% of them, have a minimum of 2 known predators. These are guys with convictions. These guys have spent time in prison. They're sitting in the pews, and I've asked every one of them, what are you guys doing? Well, we have 2 adults that keep a watch on them. What else? And like, there's a big question mark over their head. And more importantly, what are you doing for their victims? And then you really, like, there's a whole paragraph of question marks. Well, what do you mean? See, we've allowed these guys to come in, and they've tuned our belief system, and they've tapped it, and they're messing with us. And so our sympathies, what my partner John calls, is misplaced sympathies. We have misplaced sympathies. We sympathize with the oppressor and not with the oppressed. So I asked my wife if she would come down for quick demonstration purposes. So I will pretend like I am the known sex offender that you guys are all keeping an eye on. And we're going to stand here, and I want you guys to just say, okay, what do we need to be looking for? So in light of all this stuff, is there anything in this room that you would see that's off, that's weird, that's cause for alarm? Bingo. So few people turn around. So this is what I was doing here. So if Natalie were a child, what happens always with your SVPs, there are no exceptions. What these guys do in our congregations, in our church services, is they're physically manipulating kids, but it's not on the small of their back, it's much worse areas. But it's a progression. They don't just start doing that. It's not like they just start groping. There's a progression. And so the reason is this. What they're doing is they're watching your eyes. So it's one thing to find a child who's vulnerable. They're like, oh, they're going to find kids with bad homes and bad home. Well, sometimes. But really, a kid is a kid. Kids are very malleable. So what they have to do is match the right kid to the right adult. So they're constantly testing the adults to find out, is this parent attentive? So they'll come up, and first it'll be a touch on the kid's shoulder as they're talking to the parents. So are your eyes looking at me, or do you keep looking at my hand with the look of, what's your hand doing on my kid's shoulder? See, if your eyes are always going to that hand, these guys aren't likely, they're not going to take it to the next step. They might, but they're not going to keep progressing, because eventually they're going to know, this is a really attentive guy. You're somebody who's, your intuition, and I could tell before I even did that, like back in the first session, like I know you're an intuitive person. They know who the intuitive people are. They're less likely to mess with somebody who's really intuitive to mess with their kids. So there was another one. So I'm not going to actually show this, demonstrate this, but this is based on a real case study that I did. This is not hypothetical. So here's the other one. We're going to have an adult over here, an adult over here, and they can't sit. So they have these contracts, and these guys have to sit in a row with no kids. And if they get up to go to the bathroom, have you all heard this? If they have to get up and go to the bathroom, then the two adults have to go up and go with them. Okay, what are you guys missing right now? So pretend we're in a row, there are no kids. My hands haven't moved, I'm not touching them, I'm not touching anybody else. What are you guys missing? And this is a big one. I'm looking, but that's not it. No, they're the adults. These guys are my accountability partners. They're keeping an eye on me to make sure. What's that?
Are you a child?
No, I'm predator. Yeah.
Oh, you're the predator.
Yeah. So I'm compliant. I would be very compliant. I'd be nice. I'd be kind. Fine, I'm not going to sit in the same row as a kid. I can't physically touch a kid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything you guys are missing?
What's in your view?
Who said that? What's in my view? Bingo, but probably not what you're thinking. This is not turned on. This is a spy watch. So you guys can pass that around and look at it. I had a case where this guy set up hidden cameras all over the church building. He was taking photos of the kids, and this guy was a little bizarre, all the way up to his oldest victim was 72 years old. You can go back to your seat, thank you. So his victims were all the way from, I think, 6 years old up to 72. He would take still shots from the pictures that he took from the videos, where he had hidden cameras in the church building. He would Photoshop them onto nude bodies of the kids with corresponding ages. You want to guess where he got his pictures from for the kids? Facebook. The parents that put pictures of their kids in the bathtub, and it's all cute, and look at my kids bathing, and they're standing up in the tub. He took the little kids' pictures and Photoshopped them. He was a postal worker. Somebody walked behind him at work, and he was looking at these images on his computer, and this person turned them in. They got a warrant, seized his computer, and found out this guy had cameras all up over at the church building. Church called me up. I consulted with them. They said, what do we do about it? I said, first thing is, you get him out of there. The guy's got a lot of victims in there. Secondly, you stand up as a group of elders, you stand before the church and you say, we don't tolerate abuse in any form, fashion, or shape. And you let them know that you take it very seriously. They were not going to tell the church. They weren't going to acknowledge it. I was like, nah, it's not going to happen with me. So then I said, you make a statement. I don't care who writes it, but I said, you guys stand side by side when you read that statement. And you say, we will never tolerate abuse. We sought professional outside help. We're taking every preventative measure to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. At the close of that service, when they did that, one of the grandsons of one of the elders came up, and he's in tears. And he walks up, and he stands beside his grandpa, one of the elders. And the elder didn't know what this kid was doing. He thought maybe he got offended or didn't know what was going on. He looked him in the eyes, and he said, Grandpa, he said, thank you for protecting people. And he said, I want to give my life to Christ and be baptized right now. And they stood up, and it just was this incredible moment. And that congregation is doing well. It's healthy. It's strong. And they just pulled together, and the elders said, we're not going to stand for this kind of abuse. That's the responses that we need to have as a church. We need to stand for the oppressed and guard them from the oppressors. All right. I know we had some other questions. We are doing a question and answer time, panel discussion at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. If anybody has questions privately you want to ask me, I'll be happy to stick around here for a while. Thank you, guys.